ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis, the host of Politics Now. And sometimes it can be hard to cut through all the noise from the Canberra bubble. But on the Politics Now podcast, bursting it wide open is our core business. I'm joined by the brightest minds at the ABC to break down the poly speak and have a chat about what's actually going on behind the scenes. It's called Politics Now, and you can find it on ABC Listen.
Well, we've got them. Hot off the press, the latest CPI numbers, and they show headline inflation easing, thanks in part to falls in fuel prices. But the trimmed figure, which helps to measure underlying inflation, came in hotter than the previous month. So where does this leave the RBA on the question of where to next on interest rates? Welcome to ABC Business Daily. I'm Carrington Clark.
And I'm ABC Business reporter Steph Chalmers.
Steph, thank you for joining me again for inflation figures. It's nice that they provide them monthly to us now, so we get this interaction once a month.
Feeling a bit of deja vu here, I have to say.
A little bit of deja vu, but this is critically important data, isn't it, for where to next for interest rates. A lot of forecasts before we get to this day from different economists, and you described it, Steph, as kind of everyone wins a prize this time around. This is a quite dense data, but most people could probably point to something which accords with what they had forecast.
Yeah, I mean, it's early days post the data coming out, less than an hour, but so far I haven't seen anyone kind of taking the mark and rewriting what they forecast, partly because, as you say, there's a couple of numbers here and they came in varying directions. So we've got the headline inflation data, which now comes out monthly, as you say, and then the monthly move is translated to an annual rate. So that's probably the number that kind of grabs the most attention. That had been predicted to decline in the month. So the consumer price index had been predicted to fall in the month. That came through. It had been tipped to fall by 0.4%. It actually fell slightly more than that, 0.7%. And that saw the annual headline inflation rate cool more than had been forecast. So it had been forecast to fall to 4.2% and it actually fell to 4%. So you'd think, hey, good news there. But this, of course, includes some items that are quite volatile, particularly at the moment, things like the fuel price, which we know are being driven by some factors, you know, beyond the realm of normal price movements. We have things like the fuel excise and the volatility in oil prices going on. So that's why we have that trimmed mean figure, the underlying inflation figure that is focused on quite a lot, that lops off the biggest price moves in either direction. So it's previously been when the fuel price was rising really rapidly, that would be lopped off because it was one of the biggest price moves in terms of prices rising. Now we've seen fuel prices come back quite dramatically from where they were. So it's being lopped off the trimmed mean figure. And that's where we saw the trimmed mean figure actually rise more than expected. So it had been predicted to come in at 3.5% annual rate in May, it actually rose to 3.6%. So that is seen as actually a sign.
And importantly, increasing from the previous month, which was at
3.4%. Yes, so it had been tipped to increase and it increased more than had been forecast. So while the headline figure eased more than forecast, the underlying figure increased more than forecast. And that's kind of an indication that perhaps that while that fuel price inflation has come off, we're starting to see it creeping in other areas of the economy.
People are obviously very focused on this data because what it means for interest rates, and that's how we opened this. And people are also fixated on which is the more important measure for the Reserve Bank. Now, from the Reserve Bank, we know that they are still targeting that headline rate. So when we talk about the target for inflation between 2 and 3%, it is a headline figure overall that that's what they're taking into account because that is what people are really feeling. But the reason there is a hyper-focus on the underlying, the trimmed mean number, is because they think that gives a better indication of which way it's heading, which way the headline figure is coming through. So I think when you see these figures, what it probably means to the Reserve Bank is some of their concerns about how potentially higher fuel costs have started to flow through in those so-called second waves. So this is going into the cost of other products. So obviously energy is a big input to the manufacturing of lots of products, but also to the growing of a lot of food products. And so once you start to see that creep through, they start to get more and more concerned. And then when you get it to go through even to services costs, that becomes even more concerned, and that's when they get really worried about it being entrenched. So going through some of the numbers, and I would actually strongly advise people to go and have a look at the ABS website. It's quite fun, maybe for numbers nerds, but I think it's quite interesting for people to go and have a look at the way that they are presenting it. It's quite user-friendly, and it's quite interesting to look at some of the tables and graphs. So the biggest single contributor is housing, which grew at 6.5%. I'll break that down in a second. But then you've also got food and non-alcoholic beverages. They were up by 3.3%, transport up by 3.3%. So when we say housing, this is not house prices. That's a really critical point. What makes up that housing group is actually things that you might not expect, like electricity, but also the cost of building new dwellings and rents. So electricity is still particularly volatile because we still had those subsidies, the rebates from the government rolling off. And so that's why we're still seeing these very elevated prices when it comes to electricity. The number they've got there is up by 21.1%. Now, obviously, that's not actually what happened. In fact, when they try to break it down, they say electricity prices rose by 3.9% over the 12 months to May 2026. That's excluding the impact of those Commonwealth and state government electricity rebates. We know, and we've just heard from the Treasurer talking about how much they are concerned about the cost in construction for housing. And so we know, again, that there's a feed through. There was already inflationary pressures in the economy in this particular area, but that is getting even worse. And then rents. Now, this is one of the ones I'm really fascinated by at the moment, because there's a live debate happening on migration at the moment. We're doing a bit of a focus on that issue on Radio National Breakfast. So rents are still growing at 3.6%. Now, that's actually come down a lot from what it was. What we have seen, though, over the past few years is rents running at a extraordinarily high rate, which obviously coincided with very high migration coming into Australia. And we had the housing minister on Radio National Breakfast this morning, and she was talking about migration and the potential impact on the housing market. And she said, yes, migration has an impact, but effectively Australia ran an experiment through COVID where we had no migration for a period, and then we had a massive increase. In the period where we had no migration, we were still seeing upward pressure on house prices. Now, I think that's true, but house price growth is very complicated. And I think the bigger determinant or driver there was because we had very low interest rates for that period as they were trying to deal with the COVID pandemic. And so we saw this takeoff in house prices. But when you look at rents, I think it's a much more immediate impact for what happens when you have high migration or no migration. So during the period we had no migration in Australia because the borders were effectively locked off, you actually saw rents falling for those years, right? So it was completely shut off. We actually saw, it was relatively small, but peaking at kind of a minus 2% when it comes to capital cities rents. And then you saw this kind of peaking of rental increases during the period where we had the highest migration, up to 8.5% in 2023, 2024. Now, it has, as I said, has come down from there, but we are still dealing with rents that are much higher than the Reserve Bank would like. And this is obviously where people most acutely feel the cost of higher housing costs, right?
Yeah, I think that it's interesting when you say housing, it's not just what you might think on the headline. As you say, measures like rents can be pretty quickly reactive to things happening because it's kind of a constant market. And as you say, when people are coming into the country and looking for housing, even if they are going to buy, they're probably going to have to rent first. So that has been elevated for some time and has added to inflationary pressures. I want to also talk about one of the other items you mentioned in terms of food that had been one of those key areas where people had suspected we would start to see the second round effects. And there was a reference in the ABS data to dairy and that transport costs had fed through there. And then the fact that transport is one of the top categories contributing to annual inflation, even though fuel is a big contributor to that category, that indicates that even though the fuel costs are coming off in this month, there's other price pressures around logistics. So perhaps, you know, even though the fuel price pressure has come off immediately, there's still some pass through in transport costs. And that's, of course, going to be felt by businesses and then in the end prices they charge.
And now I think the difficulty for forecasters is to say, okay, we've got these peace negotiations currently happening between Iran and the US. There does seem to have been quite extraordinary moves to allow Iran now to send its energy supply, its oil, into the global market. I mean, it's kind of undoing decades of sanctions against the Iranian regime. That's expected to, at least in the shorter term, flood the market with a lot more oil, and we have seen an almost immediate impact on the price. There is a question about how sustained that can be, and obviously there's the major question is, can they actually get to a proper peace agreement in the next whatever's remaining of the 60 days? But that question about whether or not we're going to have sustained higher energy prices than we had before the war. So on one hand, we know that there has been extensive damage to energy infrastructure in the Gulf, both on the Iranian side, but also other Gulf partners. So that you would think would lead to lower supply in the medium to longer term. But at the same time, if Iran's able to operate in that market, perhaps we will see more Iranian oil going into the market, and that would mean lower oil costs. What do you do if you're the Reserve Bank and you're trying to predict which way it's going to go from here? Because as we heard from Michelle Bullock, the governor of the Reserve Bank, if you wait to see it on either side, you're probably too late. So if they wait to see whether or not inflationary pressures are continuing to build and then act, perhaps they've moved too slowly. But on the other side of that equation, if you wait too long to wait for it to look like it's falling, then maybe you've also missed the boat on that.
Yeah, you'd have to think that there'd be some people in the RBA headquarters high-fiving about the 6 weekly meetings rather than the monthly meetings. It really is convenient for them at the moment, you'd have to say.
And
that.
This is because they moved. They were previously meeting every 4 weeks or once a month except for 1 month a year, and now they have moved to a slightly extended breaks between the meetings.
Yeah, exactly. So it means that, as is the case in the upcoming month of July, we won't get a July RBA meeting. They'll be meeting in August, and that means they'll get actually more inflation data, including quarterly, more comprehensive figures before their next meeting, which you would have to think is a relief, especially in the current environment, and kind of buys them a bit more time. I didn't do the maths. I wonder if the 60 days expires before the next RBA meeting, maybe just not. But yeah, it gives them some more time to see practically what plays out. But as you say, they obviously can't target inflation that's already happened. They're really supposed to be forward looking. And I think that's why, even though you said they obviously target keeping that headline inflation rate between 2% and 3%, why they would really be looking at those underlying figures to give them a sense of, is this becoming more entrenched and being passed through beyond fuel prices and other volatile measures, because that will hopefully give them a better indication of where inflation will be heading in 6-12 months' time. And in August, we'll get those updated forecasts, so we'll be able to see what the Reserve Bank economists have made of everything. I mean, who knows how accurate the forecasts will end up being. But yeah, I think it's a difficult situation. As you say, you can't really forecast it one day to the next, let alone trying to project 6 months out from now.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right to point out they'll get another inflation read before they have to make the decision on interest rates. They'll also get both tomorrow's unemployment numbers, but also a second lot of that data before they have to make that decision. So they will be data rich, and we'll get the updated statement of monetary policy to go along. We'll get basically a whole new set of updated forecasts about the economy and how they think this is playing out. So that will be fascinating to see. Let's turn to something else that has changed recently, which is the government has now done the deal. They've clinched the deal with the Greens when it comes to the passage of the CGT changes, the negative gear changes. Now, what the Greens were able to negotiate was a change when it comes to the ability of self-managed superannuation funds to borrow money in order to buy residential property. Is it fair to say this is a pretty niche issue, but potentially was gaining traction because we were seeing people, spruikers, I think it's fair to call them, suggesting that this was a way that people could get around these changes and still get some tax advantages by investing in residential property?
Yeah, so I had kind of seen this referred to as a loophole, and then yesterday the news of the deal came through, and then about 20 minutes later got a bit of a tardy PR email spruiking some talent available to discuss how people should look at investing in property through their self-managed super fund now that other measures of investing had kind of been reduced in their attractiveness. So I think it is fair to say that this was kind of a sector that was potentially ripe to see people moving into for a tax advantage when investing in property. So it's worth kind of talking about what this actually is. It's called limited resource borrowing arrangements. So it's a loan you can take out through your self-managed super fund, and it's a very specific type of loan because obviously the point of super is to set people up for retirement. The idea of this loan is that if you defaulted on the loan, the liability is limited to the asset you were investing in. So, for example, a property you've purchased with that loan. So it wouldn't wipe out all of your super. It would just be limited to that property. And that's obviously kind of a safeguard measure. You can't just go into your super, use your super to buy a house and then potentially, you know, wipe out all your super if it turns out to not have been a good investment. So it's quite an, as you say, niche kind of loan. It hasn't been offered by the major banks for a few years. It's more smaller second tier lenders. So it's not something that most people are going to really come into contact with, I don't think. And as with a lot of these super arrangements that are beyond the kind of normal setup, it really is, you know, higher value super accounts that are accessing these measures. So looking at some stats from the ATO, from the 2023-24 tax year, it was accounts with between 500,000 and a million that mostly were using limited recourse borrowing arrangements, followed by accounts with 1 to 2 million, and then the next most used group was 50 million plus. So not many people having that amount of super, yeah. I don't think.
You will still be able to buy residential property through self-managed super funds, right, if you have the whole balance
yes.
available to you to do so. You just won't be able to borrow in order to do that.
Yes, so it's about these limited recourse borrowing arrangements, which is a very specific type of loan and the only loan that you could use to buy housing through super. You can, of course, still buy it outright. And yep. it's worth saying that those ATO figures also included commercial property. Commercial property will still be able to use these arrangements. And like a lot of the CGT negative gearing, it's not going to affect loans that have already been taken out. It's yep. not going to affect loans that are sort of in train, you know, going to settle. There's going to be a particular period, I think it was 45 days or something, that if you're already in train, you have that to keep the arrangement ongoing. So I don't think there's going to be a huge public outcry. Of course, we've heard an outcry from the self-managed super fund sector. And one of the points they were raising was that the government was already undertaking a kind of investigation into lead generators. So people might be familiar with the Shield and First Guardian collapses last year, super products yeah. and platforms that are outside the kind of normal APRA-regulated super funds that people lost a lot of money on. And there were concerns about lead generators, which are people through things like social media ads or cold calling, you know, trying to garner people's interest and take their super money out of regulated products and put them into their products. And the Self-Managed Super Fund Association today was saying they were already doing this investigation into lead generators. Wouldn't that have been a better way to deal with this? So I don't know if that's a great selling point on, you know, why this should have continued to be allowed if this is the kind of thing that people are spruiking, saying, hey, look into this to get
yeah.
a and bigger gain on your super.
And I think it is consistent if what the government is claiming they're trying to do is to make residential property a less speculative asset investment class, right? They're trying to say, first and foremost, property should be about shelter. That's what we should be encouraging people to own the house that they want to live in. And yes, some people can choose to invest in it, but we don't want it to be this speculative asset that's growing at a very high rate. And so this is just trying to take some of that heat out of the market. But obviously the counterpoint to that is that property has been a vehicle for wealth creation for a lot of people, and that you're cutting off that possibility for certain segments, or you're at least not giving it as big a tax advantage. But I think you're right. I think it's a relatively small group of people, though that the politics of this are interesting, that the Greens have been willing to do this deal in the first term of the Labor government. The Greens were taking a more aggressive position when it came to negotiation, particularly over changes to housing policy, investment in social housing, etc. It seems that this time around they've decided they want to be players in the game. And so, yes, they haven't got everything they wanted, including basically getting rid of the grandfathering rules when it comes to investments in property. But they thought they could get something by doing this deal, and that's what they've done.
And by the same token, I don't think this is something that, you know, Labor would have been really concerned about maintaining this exemption for lending within SMSFs. It seems like potentially a bit of a political win for them to, you know, make this deal, be seen to making a concession to the Greens, but really it kind of goes to where they were trying to go with simplifying taxes on property, and, you know, they'll get more tax revenue as a result, which will make up for some of the other carve-outs they've given to small businesses and startups and things like that. So, yeah, I don't think there's a lot of political skin lost for Labor on the SMSF front.
And just finally, Steph, I want to talk about something that's been kind of interesting to me over the last 24 hours, which was that we were getting reports of customers getting a bad surprise, which was an unwelcome surprise, which was that their electricity bills, which they would have thought based on the headlines last month that electricity prices were going to be going down, that people's bills would be smaller, that in fact for some people they were actually going to see their electricity prices, the amount that they were paying, go up. Now, I think part of the story here is just how complicated the electricity market is, and some of the terminology is particularly confusing. But what did you make of, first of all, these reports, and how worried should people who haven't yet received a bill from their electricity retailer or any notice, how worried should they be that perhaps their electricity prices are going to also be going up?
Yeah, well, for me, the reports first landed in my letterbox when I got my own bill, and I thought, what is going on here? Both my supply charge, which is that sort of fixed daily charge that goes along with your electricity bill, and the kilowatt per hour charge went up. And yeah, I was surprised because I had heard that the default market offer was going down. I did know, and other people may know, the default market offer isn't something that most people are on. I think it's less than 1 in 10 people will be on that default market offer. So that's kind of a price cap. So it's
a price ceiling as opposed to a price floor, I thought, saw it described as.
Yeah. So it's a rate that, you know, they have to offer, and they have to move it in line with what the regulator sets. But the way some people have been explaining it is that in order to offset that falling, retailers have been increasing some of their cheaper offers. So while 1 in 10 people might be on that market offer, a lot of people will be on more competitive rates because they're, you know, trying to get market share. The retailers will offer special sign-up deals and things like that. So you would have been paying below what the market offer was, and now you will be potentially paying more because some of those cheaper plans are actually being increased so that the profits of these retailers doesn't take as big a hit overall.
And one of the things that – one of the interesting characteristics of this this current period is that perhaps people who use less electricity are the ones who are going to be slugged with the biggest increase, because we're seeing that set component, the stable kind of component, which is in some ways for the transmission lines, etc., that is going up, whereas the variable cost is not necessarily going up by as much. Sometimes it's going to be falling, but that means if you're not using as much electricity and the stable costs are going up, then you could be the one actually paying the bigger cost increase.
Exactly. And I think the reason that has occurred is because obviously we've seen the advent of batteries, much more widespread rollout. So that's affecting how much people are using. So there's had to be this kind of rebalancing to put more weight on the supply charge so that retailers can keep covering their network costs. But it hasn't come without raising the eyebrows of the regulators, and the Energy Minister, Chris Bowen, wrote on Friday to the Australian Energy Regulator to get them to look into this, because his words were that people's prices should be going down overall. Most people should be seeing price decreases. Mm. And we heard that echoed from a lot of the retailers we reached out to, because we put a call out in our blog and we were kind of flooded with messages from people being like, I saw that, my bill's gone up, my bill's gone up. So it is interesting that, you know, obviously it's not an insignificant number of people who are experiencing this, but the message from the retailers and the minister is that overall people should be seeing lower prices. So he's asked the regulator to look into this, and also around how those price changes have been communicated yeah. to people. Because if the retailers are paying less to supply energy, then that should be passed on to consumers. They shouldn't just be increasing their supply charge, that fixed charge, if it's not warranted.
And again, there's a debate around the amount that people who have solar and have been feeding back into the grid, about how much they've been receiving. We know that those rates have been, those tariffs have been going down over multiple years, and that looks to be the case. The issue, of course, being if you're seeing all of the electricity coming from solar panels hitting the market at the same time, then, you know, supply and demand mean that you're going to be receiving a lower tariff. Batteries have changed that market quite dramatically. If people are able to store their excess electricity and then feed it back, you might be getting a better tariff at different points of the day. But, I mean, we are in this point of transition, aren't we, where it's complicated. People obviously don't want to ever see their prices going up. And so, you know, the best advice always, shop around if you can and see if you can get a better deal.
Yeah, and I think just that point of how complicated these bills are, you know, I hope that I'm fairly well educated and across this stuff, and I even struggle looking at, you know, when you've got
a lot of numbers,
your gas, your electricity, it's really difficult. So there are government websites where you can plug your bill in and it will tell you who the cheapest provider is, and that tends to be the advice is loyalty doesn't pay, especially with things like this. You know, go with whoever you can who's the cheapest, and then ask your current provider if they're willing to pay to keep you.
Great advice there, Steph. Not financial advice, but helpful advice. That's it for today's episode of ABC Business Daily. We'll be back with another episode tomorrow. Make sure you're following us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to send in a question, you can email abcbusinessdaily@abc.net.au. Catch you next time, Steph.
Bye.